The meeting will come to order, please.
Okay.
And I believe Representative Murdoch has been looking over the minutes. Representative Murdoch moves the minutes of January 18. And members, I've noted that Mary Ciccone's last name is misspelled. Mary, we will correct that. It's an S. We'll make sure it's a C. Poor Melissa, I don't think anyone had shown her how to spell your name. So with that, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion carries, and the minutes are adopted. Members, today is another exciting day, at least for me. I hope it is for you as well, because we continue on our agenda to look at various educational reforms. And today we are pleased to have with us the Minnesota Business Partnership, Executive Director Charlie Weaver, Peter Hutchison from the Bush Foundation, he is the president, and Susan Hegard from the Bush Foundation, she is the Vice President of Educational Achievement, and they're going to set before us, as you can see on the screen, the ways to create a world-class educational system. So with that, will our testifiers please come to the table? One or all, welcome, Mr. Weaver.
Thanks.
It's great to have you sitting in front of us, and please say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm Charlie Weaver with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and I'm here today to talk about a report that we did a couple years ago, but I think it's still very relevant to what you all are working on in the Education Committee and as the legislature as a whole. So let me just give you a little background, though, before getting to the report, then I'll turn it over to Mr. Hutchison to focus on what I think is probably the most important part of what we can do going forward, and that is getting top-notch teachers in our school systems. The Minnesota Business Partnership, just as a little background, is an organization made up of the CEOs of Minnesota's largest companies. We've been around since 1977. We represent 400,000 people in Minnesota who work for these companies like Target or Cargill or Best Buy or 3M or Mayo Clinic. And interestingly, we represent over two million people globally. So when you think about that, what that says is that only 20% of the people who work for the companies that I represent work in Minnesota, which demonstrates the main point I want to make today, which is we live in a global economy. And our workers and our companies derive much of their business, much of their sales outside of Minnesota. Minnesota remains a very important, obviously, part of their business. They're located here, they're headquartered here, but we live in a global economy, and that's really the basis for what I wanted to talk about. Now, we all want to grow jobs. That is, I think, the theme of this legislative session. Everyone ran on that idea of we want to grow jobs, and I want to emphasize to you that the business community agrees with that. There's nothing more important to growing jobs in this state than education, than a top-notch education. We've believed in that. It was really the reason the partnership was formed back in 1977 was around early education at that time. And we view, and I think the entire business community views education as a top priority. Frankly, we are linked. The success of the business community and the success of growing jobs in the state is linked to quality education. If we don't have a good education, we can't grow jobs. So I want to emphasize that this isn't a partisan issue by any stretch. Everyone wants to grow jobs, and we agree that we aren't going to be successful if we don't have a top-notch education system. But the world has changed. And a few years ago, there was a study done to try to get a sense for, at that time, there was a lot of worry about U.S. workers and can we compete in this new economy and how are we going to compete. And the study was done in 2005, and they concluded that if U.S. workers are to compete in this world economy that's knowledge-based, which is a change and driven by technology, the education system has to improve substantially. So we need to change. Education used to be a competitive advantage here in Minnesota. It used to be that's why our great companies were born here in Minnesota, grew up in Minnesota. It used to be our competitive advantage. It's cold here, as we know from this morning. It's a tough, we're in the middle of the country, but we succeeded because we had a great education system. As I said before, this isn't a partisan issue. When you talk about the need for change, you can look to the president. as someone who's advocating for education reform. The Secretary of Education is going to be here tomorrow talking about the need for education reform. So the idea that we need to get better and do better in this country and in the state is not something that's partisan at all. It's supported by mayors, governors, presidents of all stripes. Now, in Minnesota, we've been lucky, as I said. We've got a lot to brag about. Our 4th and 8th graders were near the top of the reading achievement in the most recent NAEP study. We've got the highest ACT scores in the last 6 straight years. We've got among the best high school graduation rates in the country. And from 95 to 2000, our 4th graders had a huge increase in mathematics compared to the United States in a national test that this legislature helped pay for a couple years ago, because we weren't sure how we were doing globally. So on the one hand, I think when we go to our constituencies and you go door to door, everyone says, my school's great. I love my school. We're doing a great job. And just for a lot of years, Minnesotans, I think all of us have been sanguine about how good we are. But the bottom line is that that's changed. We aren't as good as we used to be. There's just a few statistics, I think, that bear that out. There's a lot more than this, frankly. One of the most startling, 40% of the class of 2008 who attended the public 2 or 4 year college needed remedial courses. That was just updated 2 days ago. And it's getting worse. The report before that, we were at 38%. Now, this should make you sit up in your seat and take notice. If we've got 40% of our kids who go to school and they're unprepared, that is shocking. And don't think it's just the kids from the tough neighborhoods. This is not just kids from Minneapolis and St. Paul. 23% of the kids from Edina, I love to pick on Edina because they beat Anoka in hockey all the time. 23% of those kids from Edina need remediation. Over 40% of the kids from my area I used to represent when I was in your chair from Anoka, Champlin, Blaine, over 40% of those kids need remediation. That is an enormous waste of money, and it's shocking. We have the second largest achievement gap between white and minority students in the country. You've heard that before. Now, that is criminal. And, by the way, our funding level for kids with disadvantages is one of the highest. So it's not an issue of funding for kids of color or kids on free and reduced lunch. We are above the national average in terms of targeted funding for those kids, but we do very poorly. And that's emphasized by the third bullet. Only 3% of the African American and American Indian ninth graders will receive a bachelor's degree. That is outrageous. We should be ashamed of ourselves that only 3% of those kids are getting college degrees. It's really an economic death sentence for those kids. And then last, compared to 8th graders in 41 countries, how do we do across the world? We're 19th in math, not very good at all, and the U.S. is worse. So even though in some measures we're doing great, when you compare us to the global economy, we've got challenges. Now, the partnership, as I said, has worked on this for a number of years. We have 4 basic principles that we look at any education issue, and I hope you, as you go through the next several months, think about these as kind of principles as you consider any kind of reform. Number one, our view has been set high standards. And we've done a great job in Minnesota over the last number of years of setting high standards. Number two, measure them. Once you set them, measure them and report on the progress of those standards by school and by student on a uniform basis. So it's apples to apples. Number three, give educators the flexibility to offer the programs. So local schools, there may be certain ways that work in some school districts. I've been in very rural school districts, downtown Minneapolis school districts. Give local educators the flexibility. Once you establish the standards, then give families the ability to choose. So those are the principles that the partnership believes we should look at any education reform around. And in Minnesota, we've done a pretty good job. But 2 years ago, we looked, as we considered this global challenge, and said, all right, we think we're pretty good, but we know the world is doing better in many countries, graduating more engineers. There's more English-speaking students in China than there are in the United States. This is a challenging global environment. How are we doing? So we set out with McKinsey, I think one of the most reputable companies in the world, to ask those 2 questions. How are we doing when we compare to the rest of the world? And second, how could we learn from the best systems in the world, apply them in Minnesota to kind of close the gap? If we aren't measuring up, what do we need to do to be the best educated students in the country, in the world? That's our goal. I think it's one we share with every legislator as well. So those are the questions we posed. And it's not an academic question. It wasn't just, we'd like to know this. Frankly, the answer to this might depend on whether Medtronic stays here, whether 3M stays here, whether Target stays here. If we aren't able to produce top-performing students, these companies simply are not going to stay here because we won't have the talent we need to continue to be the best in the world, and that's what those companies are. So there's good news and bad news out of this report that McKinsey did. And they compared our education system internationally to top-performing systems in the world, and they found that we're very competitive in two areas. There were six general areas, and in two of them we compete very favorably. Academic standards, as I said before, are very high, and our assessments are good. I think we took a step backwards 2 years ago, frankly, when the legislature and the governor eliminated the math requirement that you show basic understanding of math to graduate in Minnesota, when every other state was doing the opposite. When every other state in the country was raising standards, Minnesota went backwards and eliminated the requirement that you have basic math skills to graduate. So I hope you consider that. But by and large, our standards are good. And school funding in Minnesota is stable and it's predictable. When you look and you look at the report, I think it's page 11, there's no question that we spend enough money. And by the way, there's no correlation between spending and achievement. Zero. So for those who argue the more you spend, the better achievement you get, that's simply wrong. What this report concluded was there's no country that spends more in the world than the United States on education. And yet we're in the bottom third in terms of results. So the link between spending and achievement doesn't exist. There is room for improvement, though, and that's what I wanted to just focus on in my last part of my comments. We do need improvements in four basic areas if we're going to compete with the best education systems in the world. Teacher preparation, that's what Peter will talk about. Recruiting top talent to high needs areas. School leadership development and using data to drive performance. Now what we did, so we figured out those are the kind of the four areas we want to focus on. What do we do? What we did is we went to the Bush Foundation. Peter had already begun kind of looking at teachers. We worked with Itasca, who's a group of CEOs also focused on education in part. We worked with the Minnesota Chamber, as you know, who's presented, I think, before to this committee on education initiatives. We brought together other nonprofits and put together a coalition, a broad coalition, to say, all right, we know where we're weak. How do we get at it? How do we fix it? So these are the groups and many others who pulled together to say, all right, now that we know what the challenges are, how can we get at it? So far, we've made some progress. Around principal leadership, we've worked with two statewide school leadership, and this is really the notion that in Minnesota and across the country, principals end up being principals of school with basically no training. Right? They become principals for a number of reasons, but by and large, we don't do a good job of training. It's like throwing someone into the brand new Target store in Blaine and saying, good luck running this Target store. Good luck running this division of Medtronic with no leadership training, no budgetary training, no training around team building or performance or assessment. By and large, they don't get much training that you need to run a school. So I know there are a couple organizations in Minnesota that do that now. Joe Nathan over at McAllister works with charter school principals to provide them training, and Kent McKell over at the U of M does a good job with traditional school principal leadership training. We've worked with both of them. We've helped them in terms of providing mentors and facilities and speakers for their programs, but the challenge, I think, is how do you bring that to scale? There's only a tiny percentage of principals in the state actually receive the kind of training they need. So the challenge going forward is how do we bring them to scale? And we're working with them. It's something that I think the legislature will wrestle with. Those are good programs. Second, on the data, supporting development of the longitudinal data study with the departments. We've worked with the department for the last couple of years. We've offered them expertise from the private sector to help them achieve the data study. Basically, you can't improve what you don't measure. I mean, it's kind of a fundamental notion. How can you fix something or improve something if you don't measure it so you can see how you're doing? We don't do a good job in Minnesota of measuring anything when it comes to education. So the data part of this effort is try to figure out how can we track data around teachers, principals, school districts, student achievement to bring meaningful information so that we can do better, kind of a basic principle. And then third, generating support for reform. The Race to the Top application was something. It was, in my 25 years in Minnesota politics, I've never seen anything like it. We brought together mayors, the governor, legislators of both sides of the aisle, nonprofits, business community, labor unions, all brought together around the effort on the Race to the Top. Ultimately, as you know, we didn't succeed, but it was a remarkable effort. People coming together saying, we need reform in Minnesota if we're going to compete going into the next century. And then last, around teacher preparation and recruitment, you're going to hear from Peter on what the Bush Foundation has done in that area. Also, our company has raised about $3 million to bring Teach for America to Minnesota, which we think is important to provide alternative pathways to teaching. And then we've supported over the last couple of years legislative efforts to pass alternative teacher licensure. We need to do a better job of getting talented people in the classroom. However we can get them, we need to do a better job. You all are going to debate that issue, already have. We think that's very important. But there's much, much more to do around getting the best and brightest into the teaching profession that Peter will talk about. So if it's okay, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to him.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weaver. Are there questions? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the Foundation for the work that you're doing in this initiative. I do have a number of questions, maybe because I spent my career in education, particularly down in schools. I was interested to your references to that district. First of all, you mentioned that 40% of students applying for colleges need remedial work. This was an issue I remember when I was teaching, and I asked one of the representatives of, it was either St. Olaf or Carleton, and the University of Minnesota, why do you admit them? What do you think is the reason they admit students who are unprepared for college?
Mr. Weaver.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Representative Benson, I would guess they do it because they need the money.
What? Say that again.
I think they want the money. They want the tuition.
All right. Then if that's the case, why are we discussing the problem in the school or the public schools, K-12? What's your solution for dealing with that issue?
Mr. Weaver.
Chair, Representative Benson, my view is that schools should be held accountable. If they aren't producing a product that can achieve at the college level, they should be held accountable. And they should be, we shouldn't be sending kids to college who are thoroughly unprepared to perform at the collegiate level. So either they should be required to, which is why we supported clear standards to graduate, so that you meet at least the basic
right
levels. And by the way, the majority of those who are, those 13,000 kids who are showing up to colleges in Minnesota, 13,000 kids who are showing up unprepared, the majority of them are unprepared around math.
Right.
That's where they need the middle effort. But there's got to be some consequence for the high schools for producing that product.
Well, Madam Chair,
Representative,
I may continue.
Benson.
Well, the consequence, in my opinion, would be that those students would be coming back with something stamped on their forehead saying rejected, and that schools have not done a good job. And I can't think of anything that would be more salutary in convincing parents that they had to see that their schools were doing a better job than if these graduates were sent back and unable to be admitted to a college. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Weaver.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I don't know if we want to stamp something on their head.
But well, I mean that figuratively, of course.
Right. But your idea of there being a consequence for the failure of high schools to prepare the students, I completely agree with. There should be a consequence for that.
Madam Chair, if I could continue.
Representative Vance, and continue.
I worked on a bill last year, which the governor did sign into law, called Self-Governing Schools. And one of the objectives of that bill was to find ways to attract the kind of people we want in education, because we tend to be drawing now from the bottom of graduating classes, where years ago it used to be towards the top. I'm just wondering if the Bush Foundation has done any specific work in finding ways to make the job of teaching more attractive.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Weaver and Representative Benson, maybe we'll wait till with that question till Mr. Hutchison presents.
And just one more,
yes,
if I
go
may.
Go ahead.
You made a comment about principles, and I do have to say I didn't have a lot of principles I thought were too helpful during my 34 years, even in Edina. But you did say that they were unprepared, and I'm just wondering, what about their administrative degrees? Was none of that preparation useful?
Mr. Weaver.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I think Mr. Hutchinson will be able to talk a little bit about the principal training as well as the teacher training. But I think we are not doing a good job in terms of preparing those principals. We could do better. And we're anxious to, from the private sector perspective, that's one thing we do well, is prepare leaders, prepare people to know how to grow a team, to develop a team, to assess, to analyze, to reward success, and help those who aren't doing it. So I think this is a good opportunity for the private sector and the public sector to come together on this. But I do think that the evidence would show that most principals, at least most principals in Minnesota, are not fully prepared. And they're anxious, by the way. They're really anxious for the help.
Yes, Representative.
You're very kind, Madam Chair, this morning. I appreciate it. I agree with you that there is no connection between spending particularly and student learning achievement goals. But there might be a relationship between spending and recruiting the kind of people you want to be teachers.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Mr. Weaver.
I think you're absolutely right. I think we should pay the good teachers more, and we should make it easier to get rid of the bad ones.
I was president of the local union in Edina for a number of years, and I can tell you the number of times very bright young teachers, especially in math and science, who would tell me, we really can't start a family, we can't pay for a mortgage with a take-home pay of $18,000 after all the deductions. We would like to have a family and children and a house. And I've just been offered double the salary in the private sector. So when you give the comment that there's no relationship between spending and student learning outcomes, I would differ in the sense that there is a difference in spending and recruiting top people. I can't imagine my son or daughter going into education. One's an economics major and the other one is a mechanical engineer. Mm-hmm. His beginning salary was considerably higher than my ending salary after 34 years of teaching.
That's right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Benson. I can relate to that. Yes, Mr. Weaver.
I think you may want to, I agree with your last point, and I think the committee may be interested on page 12 of this document. It talks about the fact, two things. Number one, on 11, it talks about the fact that the U.S. spends more than any other country in terms of years, but do we spend it smart? And I think that gets to your second point. And if you look at the chart on page 12 on the bottom, Minnesota specifically, in terms of the percentage of the money spent on teaching versus non-teaching, you can see that for some of the more successful countries, they spend much more of the money that actually gets to the teacher. And so I think a good question for this committee is not only, you know, what's the adequate level of spending, but is it being spent in the right places as well?
Representative Griley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I just have one question for Representative Weaver. I always want to still call you that. I remember your days in the legislature when you were always a big champion for special education and special education funding, and you made the statement that the United States spends more than any other country, and that there's no correlation between how much we spend and the product and the results. And I would be the first to say, you know, I'm excited to not talk too much myself because I want to hear this presentation. I'm very excited about the Bush Foundation grant and Mr. Hutchinson's work. But I can't not challenge you on your statement there, because if you count inflation with Minnesota's education funding and then factor out building costs, that building expenses that school districts can't really control, and then you factor out special ed costs that districts are mandated to do, can't control, and every time we try to reduce mandates, we have a hue and cry. I remember Representative Segrin at the time and myself trying to reduce some mandates, and you were the one leading the resistance. but trying to get rid of some mandates. But were it not for building costs, special education that we're Cadillac on in our country compared to other countries, then your statement about us spending all this money compared to other countries wouldn't be true. And so I just want to give you that piece of information in case you haven't kept up with that.
Mr. Weaver.
Oh, Madam Chair, it's great to see you, Representative Graham. Yeah. I've missed you. Seriously, you do a great job. And I remember we had these discussions back then. I'm happy to reduce as many mandates as we can, but I do have a soft spot for special education for sure. Mm-hmm. And there's no question that the federal government has not lived up to its promise on special, and it does put more burden in schools, shift money. There's no question about all that. However, the data, I think, is clear, though, that even given that, and McKinsey, when they do their country-to-country analysis, does factor out for special education. Some countries do not include kids in the testing, and they factor out for that. And mm-hmm. once you do that, I can't argue with their data that shows that we are a high-spending country, and we just aren't getting the results we should.
Mm-hmm. Representative Crawford.
Madam Chair, I would like to hear from Mr. Hutchinson, then I'd like to be put back on the list.
Okay, thank you. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just back on policy issues, and good morning, Representative Weaver. I too had the privilege of serving with you and have fond memories of having some fun debates on the House floor with you. I walked in, and I apologize for being late. I walked in as you were referencing the math standards and assessments, and I just want to say, because this issue keeps coming up, and appropriately so, because we kind of really put that issue on a holding pattern. But I don't want folks to get the impression is that we have walked away from high math standards in the state of Minnesota. And in fact, our standards are so high that the Pelletti administration really struggled with whether or not to join in on the Common Core assessments or standards movement. Frankly, because our math experts in the state of Minnesota were looking at, you know, what these regional bodies, national bodies, were coming up with, and telling us, boy, you know, they're aiming at standards that are way below than the ones that we have in our state. We weren't the first state to require Algebra 1 in 8th grade, but we're certainly among the leaders in doing that. We currently have Algebra 2 teed up for high school completion in our state. We still do assess our students. They are required to take the MCA2s, and of course they're required to pass those courses, including eventually passing those Algebra 2 courses in order to obtain a high school diploma. What we did do, however, is that we did hold off for a few years the high stakes component of the grad math assessment. Because we wanted to come up with a fair way of knowing whether or not our system is working in for these students and whether students are in fact performing. And your organization sat in 2 summers ago at a broad coalition of groups, mostly educators, but with the business partnership and the chamber at the table as well, to design a what I think is a superior and better way to assess students in all our high school graduation standards. It's certainly one of my grievous, you know, experiences that last year we didn't pass an education bill that among other things had this proposal that came out of. It's called the Access proposal, and I'm hoping we've introduced the bill again. I'm hoping that we will have this discussion again, get Minnesota back on. Using a fair, solid assessment for our students, and I'm hoping that the business partnership will work with all of us to be able to push forward the concepts of the Access group. I would hope we would do that as opposed to just simply re-implementing the grad math, because I do believe that approach, probably a good first effort, but really not doing what I think it should be doing on behalf of our students and on behalf of our school. So I just wanted to call that out very quickly, and then also, you know, just kind of publicly, Charlie, just ask you and the business partnership to work hard to make sure that, in fact, we do come up, Madam Chair, with a strong assessment, and particularly in the math standards for our state.
Mr. Weaver.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, we will look forward to that. I've loved working with you in the past. We've worked together in some of those hot, small conference rooms to try to work out a deal. We do think that, and you're right about the assessments, and you and Representative Carlson and Representative Greiling were key in getting those high standards, and we appreciate that and support that. We do think, though, that there should be some accountability, that we should, that employers in the state need to know that when they're getting a graduate from a Minnesota high school, that they at least have a basic level of understanding reading and math. And so we like the idea of you can't graduate, or maybe there's a dual diploma or something, but there's got to be accountability for having basic, whether it's you can't graduate unless you can show basic competence around math, or there's some other assessment. As long as it's meaningful, we look forward to working with you.
To that point, Representative Peterson, or may I go on?
It's a follow-up.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question, and talking about the remediation in high school, did you do or have any data about post-secondary options programs, and is there a higher rate of remediation with those students, or are those all prepared then as they enter the college? I'm curious.
Mr. Weaver.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, that's a great question. I don't know. They just finished. It was Minsky and U of M that did the analysis. That's a great question. I don't know. But thank you for bringing up PSCO, though, because I think that's a good example of how the business community and Governor Perpich work, and the legislature worked very closely together. And I think this legislature and this governor, frankly, could replicate much of what Governor Perpich achieved working with Democrats, Republicans, and very closely the business community to establish some of the best things we've got, open enrollment and post-secondary enrollment options being two of them.
Representative Peterson, follow-up.
But I was questioning at the rate of remediation with those students versus others, and there would be interesting to have data to see if those students do need remediation or are they ready for college because of that particular program.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Weaver.
Representative Peterson, that's a great question. I'm sorry, I don't know. I didn't do the study, but I would grab the U of M or Minsky first and next time around.
Representative Myra.
Madam Chair, Mr. Weaver, members, I'd like to make two comments. First of all, it is so important to have an effective educational system, not only because it's in our Constitution, not only because we want a strong workforce and to create jobs, but also educational failure is cruel. I speak from experience. My family moved to the United States when I was 6 and a half. I was enrolled in Bloomington School, and when I entered fifth grade, after 4 years of being in that school, pardon me, I had nil reading skills. In fifth grade, I achieved, under the supervision of a wonderful teacher, I gained all 5 years back. I was fifth grade, ninth month leaving there. I want to say, failure is cruel. It's cruel for those children. And it was a wonderful experience having an effective teacher and a wonderful program that was for me, and it changed my life. My second point is I've been here about 2.5 weeks at the Capitol, and daily, numerous times, I'm hearing the phrase, closing the achievement gap. I have a problem with that phrase, not because I don't want children that are failing to succeed. The problem with the phrase is that when you close a gap, we're assuming that we're bringing those kids at the bottom up, but you can close a gap by bringing those kids at the top down or having mediocrity. I would challenge this committee to have a different mindset, to think in terms of unlocking learning for all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Weaver, would you like to comment on that?
Or? No, I think no. Mr. Hutchinson is far more interesting than I am, so I think you should get to him.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have a question. You had a chart up there, and you said the class of 2008, and I wasn't sure if you were talking about graduates from high school in 2008 or if you were talking about the new enrollees in 2008 in college? And I've got a follow-up question, depending on
Mr. Weaver.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I believe that's the graduates from high school in 2008 who are showing up to our colleges over the last 2 years.
Okay, the reason I ask that question is that, as we all know, our colleges and universities, the average age of students is going up and up. And in fact, I think in our two-year institutions, it's about age 30. And so some of those, or many of those students, have been out of high school for some time. And maybe you could double-check on that, because I think that might make a difference in the results. And the other is a comment. I'm a retired teacher, as you may remember, and I recall when we were dealing with the high-stake test issue here in the legislature, the high school I taught at was where your sidekick there had a lot of his press conferences, Edison High School, and we were about 35% to 40% English language learners. And there was a lot of talk back when I chaired the Education Committee about problems with the math test. So I did an experiment. They'd given us some sample questions, and I gave my students in the typical class is about 35-40% English language learners the test as they were provided to us in this committee, but a written math test or question. And the English language learners, by and large, had a terrible time with that. I did a follow-up test as a part of my experiment, giving them as math problems, and they got them virtually all right. So the question that I have, or the comment I have, are we really testing on those math tests reading ability and the ability to read, in that case, the English language, or are we testing their math skills? And I think that kind of gets blurred depending on how that test is given, but something to think about on those 2 points.
Thank you.
Mr. Weaver.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I did have the same question you did when this study came out of remediation and the level of remediation in colleges, and it is limited just to people within the 2 years of graduation. So they are not including the people who have been out for 10, 15 years. But on the second point, I think that's a fair point.
Representative Kiefer, last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Weaver, you mentioned that money does not necessarily equal achievement. I was wondering if you had any data on number of students per teacher.
Yes.
Mr. Weaver.
Madam Chair, McKinsey is also taking a look at class size and whether it matters. And an exhaustive report. It wasn't part of this effort, but I'd be happy to get you the data. And their data shows clearly class size doesn't matter. If you have a good teacher, what Mr. Hutchinson will talk about, if you have a great teacher with 60 or 100 kids in the class, those kids will succeed. If you have a lousy teacher with 5 kids, those kids will fail. So it's not about class size.
Thank you, Mr. Weaver. Representative Weaver, I served with you also, and it's a pleasure to have you in front of us. Welcome, Peter Hutchinson, to our committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Peter Hutchinson. I'm the president of the Bush Foundation. I'm joined this morning by Susan Hegard, who's our vice president for educational achievement. And we're going to share with you some highlights of our work, which focuses almost exclusively on the preparation of new teachers. As we do that, just a couple pieces of background. Archibald Bush was a farmer's kid from Granite Falls, Minnesota, who found himself in Duluth about 80 years ago because he had asthma and realized he couldn't be a farmer. And he enrolled in a Duluth Business College to get a degree in accounting, and before he got done, he got hired by this little struggling company. A guy named McKnight was the accountant, hired him as the assistant accountant, and the two of them ran 3M for 46 years. And we're here because Mr. Bush and actually his sidekick McKnight each created these wonderful foundations, which are a great legacy for our state. Have done so many wonderful things, and I feel honored to be a part of this organization. The Bush Foundation's mission is to focus on trying to catalyze the courageous leadership we need to solve tough public problems. And if there is a tough public problem that we face in Minnesota, it's educational achievement. And by the way, it isn't unique to Minnesota. We'll talk a little bit about the national scene. And we're going to show you more charts and graphs and talk about statistics. But before we do that, I want to make one of these statistics real. This is an experience I had in 2006. As some of you may remember, I had the temerity to run for governor then, and I was in a bar in Deer River, Minnesota, because I was sure there were votes in this bar in Deer River, Minnesota. And I'm quite confident that not a single soul remembers that I was there. I was going down the bar saying hi to people, and this young woman was sitting down at the end of the bar, and as I got to her, she whirled around on her bar stool, and she looked me in the eye, and she says, "You lied to me." And I said, "Geez, you haven't even given me a chance to lie to you. I mean, what did I do?" She said, "I don't mean you personally. I mean you, policy people. You lied to me." So what happened? She said, "I did everything you told me to do. I went to school every day. I did my homework every night. I got straight A's. I graduated from my high school with a Minnesota high school diploma that said I had learned stuff. I enrolled in college right away, like you told me to do, and they told me I had to take math and reading over again." I've never gotten over that young woman. It had more effect on me than anything other than raising my own kids. We can't let that happen. And as Charlie just told you, we let that happen 40% of the time. And it's kids everywhere, literally everywhere. And to me, this is the tough public problem we got to solve. It just cannot be true for our kids, no matter who they are and what their circumstances. So what we want to talk about is kind of how we've come to think about this, and we want to suggest to you some ways in which not only the state, but the K-12 systems and others need to be engaged in resolving one of our core challenges, which is the future of teaching. Now, we face three big challenges in education. One is attainment. It's too low, and it's not getting better. The second is the risk. We're at a time when the education system might actually be a drag on our economy, which is unheard of in Minnesota, and the disparities, which are huge and cruel. First, on attainment. Charlie referenced the National Assessment of Educational Progress, and the horizontal line on this graph looks at both the national numbers and Minnesota numbers for fourth grade reading. And the thing you'll notice about this set of lines is that they're horizontal. 35 years ago, the average national score on the NAEP reading test was about 215, and 35 years later, it's about 215. 35 years, we've made no progress. And Minnesota's better than the nation, so our horizontal line is above the national line, but the point is it's horizontal. In all these years, all these reforms, all the things we've tried, we haven't raised the NAEP score in reading in fourth grade at all. The other line on this chart looks at the question of how much we spent. In Minnesota back in 1975, in today's dollars, so there's no inflation here, in today's dollars, we were spending just under $6,000 per student. Today, we're spending almost $11,000 per student. This is Charlie's point. It's not that Minnesotans haven't made a commitment to education. We have. Our commitment hasn't paid off. We need to get a better return on our investment in our kids. And so the challenge is, you know, how to do that. What do we need to change to make that happen? Going forward, 69% of the jobs in Minnesota are going to need a degree after high school. You got to keep that number in mind, 69%. Just hold that in your heads for a second, because this is what is actually happening in Minnesota. About 27% of our kids are ending up with a degree after high school. This is a two-year degree or a four-year degree or a six-year degree. So if 69% is the target and 27% is the current performance, this is a problem. This actually is a unique circumstance where education may be holding us back. We can't let that happen. Now, you see what happens along the way. Only about half the kids show up ready for school. Only about 36% of them are proficient in reading by grade four. math is not a whole lot better. Three-quarters graduate from high school, 58% enroll in post-secondary, either two-year or four-year, less than half of them finish. So every step along the way, we're losing the chance to get to that 69%. So it's not that any one thing is not working. It's every step along the way we've got challenges. And as Charlie said, the disparities are gigantic. They're just absolutely gigantic. Well, at the foundation, we looked at, given that background, we looked at where could you intervene? What are the kinds of things you could do? And as Representative Carlson suggested, I was a school superintendent for 4 years in Minneapolis and tried almost everything that's on this circle. And I can tell you it didn't work. We've tried so many different approaches to improving educational outcome, and yet I think the data suggests that we're not getting there. And at the foundation, as we looked at the data for teachers and teacher effectiveness, it became clear that this was an area in which we should choose to focus. Now, we're not saying this is a silver bullet, but I can tell you from my own experience, this is an area in which we haven't made much of an effort. And why does it matter? These next two graphs, to me, are the most important. So this is from Tennessee. Take groups of kids that are at the 50th percentile. They're performing at an average level. Give one group of kids 3 years of top 20% teaching. So these are the teachers that produce the greatest gains year in and year out. Give those kids, those teachers, 3 years in a row. And they'll move from the 50th percentile to the 90th percentile. Start with the same kids. Give them bottom 20% teaching, so teachers that produce the smallest gain. Give them those teachers for 3 years in a row, and they'll drop to the 37th percentile. Now, what this graph doesn't tell you is those kids will never recover. Miracles like yours are rare. Yeah. Really rare.
Yes, it is.
And so the question is, how can we make sure that our kids get that top 20%? How can we have more of that top 20% in our schools? And this is about the achievement gap. This is actually from Dallas, another way to break down the statistics. And what I want you to notice about this is how much difference great teaching makes for the kids who need great teaching the most. So what happened here is you divide the class into three groups. One group is the highest performing fourth graders. That's the group on the far right. The middle is the middle performing fourth graders. The left is the lowest performing fourth graders. And the colors have to do with whether they got great teaching every year or not such great teaching every year. And what you can see is for the highest performing fourth graders, doesn't make such a big difference. It makes a difference, but it's not overwhelming. Even the middle performing, not such a great difference. But look at those lowest performing fourth graders. 3 years later, great teaching has virtually closed the gap by raising performance. Great teaching really matters. Now, this is one of those duh moments, right? We've all said this over and over and over, but I think this is powerful data about what difference great teaching can make. And it raised for us at the foundation, okay, what could we do about getting that kind of great performance? And with Susan's help, we've crafted an approach that we'd like to share with you and then talk a little bit about what it takes from organizations like ours, from the larger community, from the legislature, and from the K-12 systems to deliver on the opportunity to create great teaching in every classroom.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hegard, and will you introduce yourself for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Susan Hegard with the Bush Foundation, and I'm very happy to be here, first time this year. So what I wanted to do in this slide is just share with you a little bit of the national perspective. We're at a very exciting time right now. Secretary Duncan will be here at a luncheon. The chamber is sponsoring tomorrow. I think there's a legislative panel, and maybe some of you are coming to the luncheon. But it's a great opportunity because a number of the things that he's been talking about are pretty consistent with the work that we've been doing. The Gates Foundation has been involved in a number of education reform initiatives over the years. Right now, though, they're focused doing some very deep work in a number of districts around the country, looking at measures of effective teaching. Some of the districts include Hillsboro in Florida with a student population of about 200,000 kids, Denver, Dallas, Memphis, Charlotte, Mecklenburg, and New York City. And what they're doing is they're looking at a structure that has value-added assessments, other measures, video, peer review, and then student feedback to the teachers, and trying to see over a period of years, and they're sinking hundreds of millions of dollars into this effort across the country. But they're trying to see whether the combination of evaluations and if each individual, each evaluation on its own, really makes a difference in improving student achievement. The Woodrow Wilson Foundation, they're working in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana, and they're focusing on master's programs. They provide a $30,000 stipend with 3 years of mentoring support, and that's key. One of the things that Mr. Hutchinson talked about was the loss of students, you know, over the period of time. They don't graduate from high school. If they do get out, then they go to college, but they don't finish. The same thing happens in teaching. People who come in to become teachers into their education, many of them don't complete, and 5 years after, a third or more are gone. And so there's a pipeline issue in the teaching profession as well. So the Woodrow Wilson Foundation is really focused on that mentoring, trying to see people through 3 years after they finish. They're focusing their graduates in high-need schools with the goal of getting them certified to be certified teachers. Carnegie Corporation, they're the folks that we've talked to quite a bit. They had an initiative called Teachers for a New Era, focusing on, I don't know, maybe 10 or so institutions across the country, public and private, trying to figure out how to change up the way in which teachers are prepared. And they just completed some of their work, I think about a year ago. We have not yet seen a report, but we've heard bits and pieces. There were some successes in that effort, but overall, I think the result, there's still some questions about the overall impact that the initiative had. And then finally, the federal government raced to the top. There was a teacher aspect to that initiative. The TIF money, the Teacher Incentive Fund that's available, the I-3 grants that many of you may have heard about, and then there are other efforts that are also focused on improvement of teaching. So our measure of success is to deliver 25,000 effective new teachers by the end of this decade. What that number represents is about 50% of the teachers who will retire by the end of the decade. Our definition of teacher effectiveness is achieving at least 1 year of student academic growth and 1 year of classroom time. That's not to say that other measures aren't important, but we're very focused on that 1 year of growth and working with some folks out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
So I just want to ask you to focus your attention on that 25,000 for just a second. What's going to happen in the next decade is half of all the teachers in our schools are going to leave and be replaced. What an amazing opportunity. We can actually influence who those next 25,000 teachers will be. I mean, we can influence that. This is an incredible moment. If we can place in those classrooms 25,000 of the very best future teachers, we can change the trajectory of education in this state. What a moment. We've never had a moment like this.
And if you think about that moment combined with, you know, the attention that the federal government has given, the attention that a number of private foundations across the country are giving to the teaching issue and others, I mean, we ought not to miss this really important moment. We're focused on five areas to support the development of highly effective teachers. And what I want to be clear about is that we're not working in all of these areas. We're working in some of them and recognizing that all are important. So the context that we're working in, it really impacts whether or not we're able to be effective as a foundation. So we're looking at the teacher preparation program development and improvement, working with 14 institutions across three states, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. We're also looking at evaluation assessment tools to enable individual and program measurements. So we're looking at the individual teacher as well as trying to improve the overall program. We're looking at a marketing campaign, very involved, trying to figure out how do you attract new and different people to the teaching profession. What would that take? And so we're working with Padilla Spear right now, trying to do a marketing campaign across the three-state area to really improve that recruitment effort, and working with our partner institutions as well. Teacher compensation, that's been mentioned several times here. We know that that's important. and we're very supportive of improving the pay of teachers. That's not something we can do on our own, but we need we recognize that that's very, very important. And the value proposition of teaching, as I mentioned, just how do you improve the reputation of teaching so that that dinner table conversation isn't, why would you want to be a teacher? You're not going to make any money, and it's a difficult job. It ought to be great. What an impact you're going to have on the lives of young people. Go. So we really want to try to improve that value proposition. And then finally, a policy environment that supports and rewards improved teacher preparation. We're a foundation. You know, we can't lobby. We can educate. You folks are the ones who can really help change up that policy environment, and we need your help very badly. This is the largest investment that the foundation's ever made, a single investment the foundation's ever made, $40 million over the next decade on these areas. Here's who we're working with. There's also a brochure, a color brochure, in your folder that explains the initiative in a little bit greater detail, and we'll show you who we're working with. But we're in three states. We are working with the University of Minnesota. And what I want to say about this is that we really try to focus on having a diverse range of institutions. So we have a research institution, we have Minsky institutions, we have some institutions in North and South Dakota, we have some who are working in consortiums together and some who are not, and private colleges as well. So we really wanted to try to bring a diverse group of institutions into this effort and then say to them, here's where we'd like you to go, but you figure out in your own innovative way how to get there, because we don't know what's going to work, and so we want them to really try some different approaches. So in the Twin Cities, the University of Minnesota is one of our partners. We're also working with a collaborative of six private institutions in the Twin Cities, the TC2 Consortium, they call themselves, Winona State University in Winona, and also they have a campus in Rochester. We're working with Minnesota State University, Mankato, St. Cloud State University, three institutions in the Fargo-Moorhead area, and that was really challenging because they're in two different states. Valley City and NDSU had worked together before with one providing the elementary program and one providing the secondary, but they hadn't really worked together with Moorhead. In fact, when we first met with the deans, they had never met each other. And one of them had been there for 17 years. So we had a meeting yesterday, and two of these partners just said, we are learning so much from each other. Thank you, you know, for helping that happen. The river floods, but it's not that wide most of the year. We're also working with USD, University of South Dakota in Vermilion, and we're trying to figure out a strategy for the Western Dakotas. We've talked with some institutions in those two states. I'm just trying to figure out, how do you serve an area that has two of the poorest counties in the nation, some of the remote, most remote, you know, sparsely populated areas in the nation? How do you serve that large geographic area? So here are the things that our partner institutions are focusing on. There are four key areas plus the evaluation assessment that I mentioned. We've asked them to focus like a laser on recruitment, because bringing different and new people into the profession is so important. So when we sat down with them and said, we asked them to do a matrix and look at what are you doing right now, what are your approaches right now, and what will be different in the future. We were surprised to find that most of them don't intentionally recruit. And what I mean by that is they don't sit down and think about who they want to have in their program. You know, is it a current student at the university who might be great at math and science but might also be a great teacher? Is it a career changer? Is it more men, more people of color, more high school students trying to focus earlier on, perhaps in middle school? They don't really think about that. It's not that they weren't interested. They just hadn't been thinking that way. So they are now. And that's really fun to observe and witness. So as I mentioned, the marketing campaign will be instrumental in helping drive some of that change. Looking at their admission standards is a critical aspect. They're all at different places, the institutions that we're working with. And wherever they're starting from, we're asking them to step up from there. And also trying to increase student diversity. And when I use the word diversity, I mean that very broadly. In terms of preparation, the traditional model has always been much more time kind of spent with your professor, and then you go do your student teaching. These folks are really looking at some different approaches. Some are looking at a residency model where it's almost all clinical. But they're all noting that it's important to get that real classroom experience earlier on, if just for the reason that you might find when you're a potential teaching candidate that it's really not for you. So really trying to blur that line between the professor and the classroom and get that to be more integrated and occur earlier on. And we're also asking them to meet with their K-12 partners, have K-12 partners, and involve them in the design process. So when they're trying to change up their curriculum, we're saying have the K-12 folks in there talking with you about that, because they're going to be able to tell you what they need and what's important. The placement aspect of this is critical. We're asking them to think hard about where they place their teachers, and that means, as was mentioned earlier, the leadership of the schools that they're placing their teachers into, so clustering their teachers, knowing that school environment, working with those partners, K-12 partners ahead of time. Placement is another very important piece of this, because we're also asking them to support their graduates 3 to 5 years after they finish. And some of the data, we'd had an earlier slide that we probably need to put back in that just shows that leakage kind of along the pipeline, and that when these folks get out and before 5 years are up, when they're getting tenure and that sort of thing, we're losing so many of those individuals. Now, some of them probably ought to go. It may not have been a good fit, but others may not have been getting the support that they need.
So I want you to hear Susan's focus on the relationship between the higher education institution and the K-12. This is a breakthrough in terms of the structure of teacher preparation. Historically, it was that the colleges produced teachers and kind of pushed them out the door and hoped that things turned out all right. And the K-12s hired them and hoped they were okay, but if they weren't, they took responsibility for trying to make them better. And there was almost no communication back and forth between the K-12 systems and the higher eds. What we've got here are 14 university presidents who have said they will guarantee that their graduates will succeed in the classrooms of our schools, guaranteeing to these school districts that if our graduates don't succeed, we will provide the support. We will provide the ongoing remediation and coaching and mentoring for up to 5 years. This has never been done, as far as we know, anywhere in the country. And for these presidents to step up and say, Judith Romaley gave a presentation in Rochester a few weeks ago in which she explained this to the people of Rochester and to the new school board. She got a standing ovation because of her commitment to the quality of the candidates that will be delivered to the Rochester schools. This is not like stuff that's happened before. And you got to give the higher education leaders here a lot of credit for their courage. But you also have to give the K-12s credit for saying, we're going to stay at the table, we're going to be clear about what we need, we're going to be pretty demanding, but we're also going to forge a real partnership to make sure that we get the teachers we really need that our kids deserve.
So the fifth area, there are four areas of focus, but then this fifth area is absolutely critical. I think it's Charlie Weaver mentioned earlier, you can't know whether you're improving unless you measure it. So we're partnering with some geniuses, as Peter likes to refer to them, because they are, out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. VARC is the acronym, V-A-R-C, the Value Added Research Center, led by a guy named Rob Meyer, grew up in White Bear Lake, and has a group of economists and engineers and data experts who are trying to figure out how to develop a value-added assessment to measure the gains and effectiveness of these teachers. Now, the value-added assessment is the core part of our measure, but other measures are also important, as I mentioned. What we want to be able to do is link students to teachers and teachers back to their preparation program to improve performance. Now, what's important about that is our goal is to use that data and the link back for program improvement. It's not to be punitive or to punish. It's to help the program improve. So we had this guy by the name of Jerry Christensen, who's a dean at University of Louisiana Lafayette. And he's a native Minnesotan, and he has been the dean at one of the Louisiana institutions for quite some time. And I read about him, and we brought him up to speak to some of our partners. What happened to him is that he had a program that was producing, he was told, fabulous graduates. Blue ribbon, you know, honors, and business people loved him. Then he got some data back from the state. And the data was pretty good overall, actually quite good for most of his program. But in elementary language arts, he was tanking. I mean, his his program in that particular area was very low. And we brought him in. So what we did is we had a case study. We put our partners, our 100 or so folks at one of our summits, our partners in, and did a case study with them. And we asked them, what would you do if you were with this dean? You've gotten accolades. Your program overall is great, but this one area is not. And then we said, by the way, you know, here he is. So we brought Jerry in, and he said, you know, at first I was really mad. He used lots of words to describe his anger. And then he said, then I started thinking, well, overall, we're doing really well. What the state is telling me is that I have a problem, and it allows me to go in and figure out what the problem is, fix it, and make it better. So I just think that it's critical to figure out a way to talk about this data linkage in a way that's not just punitive, that's not punitive, that really leads to improvement in performance. That's our goal. And then what's also really exciting is that we have a common metrics group, so we have representatives from all the 14 institutions together at the table figuring out what are those measures going to be in addition to the value-added assessment. So they're looking at an exit survey. They're looking at an entrance survey. They're looking at the TPA, which is the teacher performance assessment. There are a number of different things that they're together working on to be able to measure the success of a teacher over the early part of their career. One of the things Peter mentioned, we probably need to find a better slide because we know that in Minnesota only about 10% of our students take the SAT, I believe. But this just was to illustrate the point that if you're looking at folks coming into teaching, they tend to come not from the top 10, 15, 25, you know, even 30% of students in colleges. And so really trying to figure out a way to improve the academics, you know, background and potential of these students is important. So McKinsey did some work for us as well. And what they did is they looked at, we wanted to figure out if we were to trying to really dig into how to attract more individuals to the profession, who are we looking for? You know, who are these people? And so they did a survey for us of high school students. We also then partnered with Education Minnesota to look at teachers in their first 5 years. So that was really fun to be able to partner with the union on that together. But on this early part, these were people who were potential teachers. And we asked McKinsey to work on this. And what they came up with was five attitudinally based segments. And so they separated these folks that they interviewed into five groups. So at the bottom, I'll start there. These are probably the people who work for McKinsey, the mercenaries. And I'm kidding. But these are folks that are very, very ambitious, good grades, focus on compensation, very ambitious, very high achievers. You have security seekers, and so those folks are really interested primarily in financial security. Compensation is really important. They wish to avoid jobs. They're risk-averse, basically, and they seek a lot of freedom and flexibility in their jobs. There are folks they called reputationists, driven by externally generated motivation. They seek jobs that are highly respected in society. They care what their friends think. And they wish to avoid jobs with the risk of layoff. And, you know, probably all of us are a mixture of a number of these things, but this is how they separated these groups. But the top two groups were the ones that they really identified as areas that we ought to be targeting and focusing on in our marketing recruitment efforts. People that have an interest in service, for whom service is a core part of their person. So first, the altruists, relaxed in pursuing impact and life balance. They want to improve people's lives and make a difference. They really strive for that work-life balance and freedom and flexibility on the job, and they also care what their friends think. And then they're the change makers, and they're probably the most, that group is the one that we want to focus most on. They're ambitious, they're willing to work for impact, strong preference to improve people's lives and make a difference in the world. They're ambitious, and they really are interested in intellectual stimulation. So it was fun to sort of sort these folks into these groups and begin to think about how we might target a marketing campaign. I don't know, Peter, do you want to take this slide here?
Sure. So, excuse me, we have a question to that slide. Could you go back to that slide, Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Hegart, Mr. Hutchinson. I've been a supporter of QCOM because I think it breaks some of the traditional culture of schools that I get out of college with my teaching degree, First day of school, the kids walk in, I close the door. 30 years later, I open the door, and nobody's been in the room for those 30 years. And so I think some of the collaboration and the like that QComp pushes is important. But I spent some time before session reading Daniel Pink's new book on drive, on motivation and kind of modern work demands, which are very much like teaching traditionally has been. Uh-huh. You need creativity, you need innovation, you need divergent thinking, you need all of these things. And yet, a lot of what we're doing in education now is directly contradictory to that. We're talking more about trying to attract mercenaries with performance pay rather than enhancing change makers and altruists. And we're doing more in terms of standardization. Here's the curriculum. I'm going to be in your room. You're going to teach it like this. On day 43, you're going to be on page 716, kind of the French model. How do we deal with these contradictions that we want to attract people who want freedom and flexibility on the job, and then once we give them the job, we want to handcuff them with everybody's got to be doing the same thing at the same time. We want people who are motivated to be there to work with kids, and yet the motivation we give them, the motivator we give them is here's the money if you hit certain metrics.
Mr. Hutchinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, this is a fabulous discussion. So let me just rewind a little bit and then get right to this. So 40 years ago, before the labor markets changed, the people that went into teaching were women that had only three career choices, and thankfully the really great ones picked teaching. And I'm a direct beneficiary of the discrimination in the labor market. And then we busted open the labor markets, and they started making other choices. And you saw the SAT thing. So the sort of the academic background of people going into teaching kept coming down. And one of our responses to that was to try to make teaching more standardized. Mm-hmm. That we didn't have that same group of really creative, energetic, driven folks that were going into teaching. So we instead said, well, we'll make it more standardized. We'll put rules in place, so it won't matter who becomes a teacher. It turns out it does matter who becomes a teacher, but we try to compensate for that. So your point is right on. If we go after these change makers, they're actually going to change teaching. They're not just going to do better, they're going to change teaching. And those of us who used to run these systems are going to have to wise up to what it means when you get really high energy, high potential performing people in classrooms. I had coffee with one just the other day, and I said, so what do you do in your district with all the rules and regulations? She says, I do absolutely the minimum that's required so I can succeed with my kids. Well, we want people like that teaching our kids. And I actually think we will experience a pushback in terms of the regulatory structure when they start delivering the kind of educational outcomes that we all pine for, and we'll give it to them because they'll be able to deliver. In terms of this market research, we learned something that really surprised me. First of all, these change makers are actually disposed to become teachers. But if you ask them, is teaching a career you would consider, an amazingly high percentage say yes. You know, like 15 or 20%. I'm not saying it's everybody, but a surprisingly high percentage. Then when you ask them about the compensation and other sort of dimensions of the job, real surprising things. The number one thing that they would like, performance pay. Mm-hmm. Not because of the pay. It's not the amount of money. It's the recognition. Mm-hmm. They want to be acknowledged for being good at what they do. Now remember who we're talking about. These are 18, 19, 20-year-olds who are thinking about the future. They're not us. These are people who are brought up in a different world than I was brought up in. They think about it differently, and they want to be recognized for being pretty good at what they do. The number two thing on their list was not starting pay, which is what I thought it was going to be. It was maximum pay, maximum possible pay.
And the equation in their mind is not whether I can raise a family and what I'm earning when I start, it's can I raise a family and what I might be able to earn in the course of my career. Number three on their list was ongoing development as a professional, which they thought of as part of compensation, that they want to get the resources and the time to keep investing in themselves and their own success. Well, that makes sense if you're a change maker. You want to keep getting better at what you do. And only number four on their list was starting pay, which says it's not unimportant, it's not trivial, but it's not kind of the driving thing. And when I saw that data, I was surprised by the content, by the sort of the order, and then had to step back and say, well, wait a minute, now these are change makers. They actually do see the world differently than I might or you might or others of us might. And I think they're signaling to us, if you want us in this deal, you've got to make it possible for us to operate in a way that makes sense for us, which is to your point that maybe all those rules and all that standardization is not going to be the only way to get this done. And I personally, as a former superintendent, I pine away for the time when teachers are pushing back really hard saying, I'll make you a different deal. You give me some space, I'll produce kids that can read and kids that can add and critical thinkers. And that would be fantastic. Because we are challenging. And this young woman that I was talking to, I mean, she's just driving her nuts. And she's thinking about leaving because she doesn't want to be driven nuts. She wants to succeed. She wants to perform. And she's not going to leave. She's going to leave teaching, but she's not going to leave education. She has passion for seeing to it that kids learn how to read. She just needs to find a different way to do it.
Representative Dabney, follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick other comment. I've got a good friend who runs a education-related foundation in town and was frustrated with some of the issues around teachers and teaching. And her point was, you know, I do 50 or 60 hours a week. Mm-hmm. I'm a professional. I get the job done, and I want teachers to act as professional as I do. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, yeah, right there with you, except we don't. We tell teachers when to show up. We tell them what they're going to teach. We tell them how they're going to teach. We tell them who they're going to teach. There's no other profession. We don't tell doctors, sit down, shut up, you're treating colds today. We don't tell them when they're going to show up and when they're going to leave. We tell lawyers show up when they're need to show up. Legislators show up when we need to show up. And don't when I need to be in my community today and not in committee. So we want teachers to act like professionals, except we don't want to employ them like professionals.
Right, and we've
Mr. Hutchison.
And we've actually created a whole set of systems, which are little things and big things, but mostly little things, that drive them crazy.
Yeah.
Right. That actually impede the very thing we say we want.
And, I think they'll be change makers if we let them.
Exactly. And my own view of this is if we succeed at bringing in 25,000 change makers, it may take a little bit of time, but it's not going to take forever because they will change us. I mean, that's the point. And the people who run these systems, including superintendent types or principals or legislators, are going to experience a different kind of pushback around the edges. But the deal will be they'll deliver us performance in return. It's not just that I want a different work environment, it's that I want a work environment in which I can succeed. And that's, boy.
Members, let's move on because we have lots of folks who have questions. And I'm sorry, Representative Benson, but maybe you can hang on to it. Please proceed.
We'll be done in like two more minutes.
Thank you.
So one of the questions we asked then, given all the work and the research that we've done, is what are the kind of things that need to be in place if we're going to be successful at this? And this is not a list for you, although there are some things in here that we hope you will think about, because there are things that the larger community has to think about, there are things the K-12 districts have to think about, there are things that organizations like ours have to think about. So we got to have recruiting. We actually have to go out and ask these change makers to become teachers. They'll respond if we ask them, but if we don't ever ask them, it's never going to happen. And so we're going to be part of launching a recruiting campaign. Our partners are going to be part of that, and we're trying to pull the K-12 systems in because, you know, the future teachers are sitting in our classrooms already. And we have like 13 years to recruit people into teaching, and the wonder is we don't do a better job. We probably need financial incentives to make teaching even more attractive, so things like tax credits or scholarship relief and that sort of thing. We've got to change admission requirements. We actually have to make it harder to get into teaching, while at the same time we're trying to recruit people more strenuously, because these change makers don't want to be part of something that isn't high class and high caliber. So that's something that this is the institutions have to think about. We've got to prepare people differently. Susan talked to you about that. That has to do, to some extent, of who can prepare teachers in Minnesota. What kind of accreditation ought we to have? And what are the requirements for graduating? What does it mean to be a graduate? What does that mean in terms of the ability of the institution to affirm and guarantee the effectiveness of those teachers? We've got to think about the support system. So how do we handle licensure and tenure? How do we handle those first few years of teaching? How do we know that data is really clear that a beginning teacher gets better every year for those first 3 or 4 or 5 years. So how do we have in place policies and systems that reinforce that so they really do get to grow in those early years?
Well, and I think also we've talked about tenure and licensure. They need to be meaningful, making sure that they're meaningful.
If you ask me about it, I'll tell you my favorite tenure story. data. One of the things that's pretty exciting for us in this work so far is the willingness and ability of the K-12 systems and the higher eds to get around data, to not be afraid of it, and to use data as a device, not to punish or any of that kind of stuff, but to drive improved performance. And one of the things that will be in the curriculum for these new teachers is the use of data as a professional to improve their own. So we're not going to have people afraid of data or uncertain about data. We're going to actually have teachers that embrace this, which will be a huge improvement. And then thinking about how we can reward these programs over time. One of the challenges we have as a foundation is we can invest in the transition to a new way. But we're not in the business of running teacher preparation programs, nor are we ever going to be. And so the financing mechanisms and these systems also need to think about how are we rewarding these institutions for doing this stuff, or don't we care? And we need to be thinking about that. So we joined up with this Minnesota Futures Initiative, and as Charlie told you, it's the business partnership, it's the Chamber of Commerce, it's the Itasca Project and ourselves. And in your packet, I think you've got something that looks like this. That is what they call the blueprint, what we call the blueprint. And so I'm not going to walk you through all the details, though we'd be happy to answer any questions. These are actually things that you could do if you wanted to get about creating a system that would assure that the next 25,000 teachers are pretty terrific and could help us improve the educational outcomes for all of our kids. And then I just wanted to take a second to let you know that at the same time that we're making presentations like this to you all and working with our higher ed partners, we're spending a lot of time with the K-12 district, because it really matters what happens on their end. That we're actually saying to them, look, get in a partnership with one of these higher ed institutions and try to convince that higher education institution that you have schools that will be ready for your new teachers. Schools that have leaders and systems in place that will support the success of these new teachers. Because if you do that, you get to be a pretty demanding customer. You get to be demanding of those higher ed institutions to actually send you the students you really want. We're actually asking the higher eds and the K-12s to start to think about, if I know that I'm going to need more ELL teachers, or if I know I'm going to have a real problem recruiting a chemistry teacher 3 years down the road, they can actually start working with their higher ed institutions to prepare the teachers they're going to need. Instead, when I was a superintendent, it was a crapshoot. We needed a chemistry teacher. We just put out an all-points bulletin for a chemistry teacher, and maybe we got one. Because we had no ongoing relationship with the higher ed system. But imagine a close working relationship where the higher ed systems could start recruiting the very teachers that these schools are going to need. So we're pressing pretty hard on the K-12 systems to say, you're not a victim anymore of the teacher preparation system. You're a partner in creating a better system, and the response has been fantastic. To watch school superintendents and principals and mentor teachers start to talk honestly with their higher education partners about the quality of people going into teaching, the quality of the preparation, the demands on teachers, it's just inspiring. And I think here in Minnesota, we got something going on. It's not going on in a lot of other places.
And the higher ed institutions are inviting these folks in. So they're inviting their K-12 partners in throughout the three states, which is really fun to see.
And when it's not fun, we got to tell you, this isn't all sweetness and light. I mean, these are pretty serious people talking to other serious people about the deficiencies of the system today so that they can correct it for tomorrow. And, you know, effective teachers really do matter most. And we're doing what we can as a foundation. We're partnering up with the people we think can be the most helpful. And we invite you into this. This is, as I said earlier, this is an amazing moment in the history of Minnesota when together the legislature, the K-12 systems, the higher eds, private sector, some of us foundation types, we actually could change education in Minnesota. Instead of looking at those horizontal lines, start looking at lines that are going in the direction we all wish they would. And I, for one, would say that's worth the effort. It's not going to be easy, but it's probably worth the effort. Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for a very powerful presentation.
Thank you.
I have one question, either of you could answer it. Have you done this presentation to groups of teachers, to those in the field, so they can give you a reaction to the goals that you have, the future that you're looking at?
We've talked
Mr. Hutchinson.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. We've talked both with groups of teachers and with groups of union leaders who are also teachers, but we wanted to also make sure that the sort of the institutional side of teaching was aware of the work we're doing, and we're getting very positive reactions. I think people recognize the power of great teaching, whether it's a colleague down the hall or whether it's part of your job to represent teachers. It's good news for everybody.
Ms. Hegard, did you have a response to that?
I was just going to add that we've also been talking with groups of superintendents. So a number of the service co-ops, we've gone out to different parts of the state and spoken with them. So it's really important that we speak with superintendents, principals, and teachers, and then community leaders as well.
Questions? Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hutchinson, Ms. Hegard, thank you very much. A lot of words and have been spoken and written over the past 30 years about education. One of them was Nation at Risk, and I remember reading that. And one of the points, there were a lot of good points in there, of course, but in order to have an effective education system, we needed adequate funding, which I think we have, very good teaching, which personally I believe we have. I'll speak for myself there. The third one was involved parents, and I think that is a problem sometimes. Poor parenting, I know it's harder to find, but we know it when we see it. So I guess my question is, does very good instruction in adequate funding, does that overcome poor parenting?
Mr. Hutchinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Crawford, yes. The data from places like Dallas, which is not terribly dissimilar from some of our toughest schools here in Minnesota, shows that indeed great teaching raises the performance for those kids furthest behind, which I think we would hypothesize are also the kids that maybe have the least parenting support. But I think the data does suggest that great teaching really does matter.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. One is the chart that you have on page 3. Education need to get more for our money, and you've got the average spending per pupil at $10,000. Is that national or is that for Minnesota? And if it's Minnesota, I wonder where you got it. We had the task force, but the governor had where it was $7,500.
Mr. Hutchinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, this is state data, and this comes from the National Center for Education Statistics, which gathers this data for all states. And so we just dipped into that data.
Okay.
And this is the numerator of this is continuing operations dollars. So it actually doesn't include capital expenditure. And the denominator is essentially full-time equivalent students. It's sort of trying to sort out the weighting and all that. It's just trying to deal with the actual with ADS.
Thank
Representative
you.
Representative Grimes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hutchinson, does it include special ed then?
Yes.
Okay. And then that would, you know, make it muddy, that statement then, with my earlier thing, because Minnesota funding has been flat since 1984 if you factor out special ed building expenses and factor in inflation. And then my other question on page 12, you have teacher compensation and other improvements to the value for teaching we do have Mr. Weaver said funding doesn't make a whit of difference. We need to get more for our money. We've got bills this year to freeze teacher salaries, and so when you talk about teacher compensation, are you talking about redistributing current dollars, or are you talking about better pay?
Mr. Hutchinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Grindham, it's what I was talking about earlier. So we did this market study to try to understand what are the dimensions of compensation that matter to teachers. We have underway now a conversation with a school district to see whether or not those principles can be put into practice in an existing situation. Because if it were only about more new money, it would be a very difficult thing to, obviously, in this environment to deal with. So we're trying to find out whether or not from the practical side of things, where the business manager and the union leaders have to agree, whether or not that information, that some kind of performance recognition, long-term pay, professional development, and starting pay, the combinations and permutations of those things can actually be turned into a contract that works in today's fiscal environment. We think it can, but you don't know until you actually go try, and so we're out trying, and when we find out, we'll let you know, and we'll let everybody else know, because we're hopeful that it can, because it seems like it's pretty important to attract these change makers into the profession, that we have a compensation structure that works for them, that is attractive from their point of view.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Hutchinson, then you are redistributing current money.
We're assuming there isn't more money, so yeah.
Mm-hmm. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both for your presentation. I'm very supportive of your efforts, and quite frankly, I think what you're aiming at is nothing short of really helping to transform our teacher prep pathways in our state. And of course, I have the alternative pathway bill that has strong bipartisan support, but I've never pretended that is, you know, the single magic bullet. I think it's an important element. I think what you're about is something that goes deeper and broader and has potentially even longer impact. I have two quick questions. One is, however, hopefully we will have a very mature, high-quality alternative teacher pathway system operating in a stable way in our state. What is the relationship in your minds between the work that you're doing with our traditional teacher prep programs and those programs coming online? And do you have expectations of, for instance, some kind of meaningful interaction and learning? If you can just say something quickly about how you think that fits within the work that you're doing.
Mr. Hutchinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I would put it to you this way. I don't, as a parent in Minnesota, I don't care where teachers come from. I only care how good they are. So the challenge we put to the 14 institutions we're working with, when there's nothing special, I mean, there's nothing unique about these 14, it's just they took on this challenge, was their willingness to guarantee the effectiveness of teachers. So I think I'd say anybody should be able to prepare teachers in Minnesota that are willing to guarantee their effectiveness. That's the transformation from my point of view. So what route they take, frankly, I'm not sure matters a whole lot if they can teach. And if that's true, then there should be massive collaboration and learning across those different systems, because I think we know that we don't know. I think we know that the system we have is not producing what we wish for. And so we need as much experimentation, if you will, around this central idea as we can get. So if it happens to be Teach for America, fine. If it happens to be what I think of as a non-traditional piece of Winona's program in Rochester, equally fine. If it happens to be the traditional approach that St. Cloud State is using, equally fine, as long as they're prepared to stand behind those teachers after they deliver them to the K-12 institutions. And what we've learned working with our partners is, when we put them all in a room and they start talking to one another, they all learn something. Right? That somebody's tried residency, so they're learning how that works. Someone else is trying a very different relationship called co-teaching, finding out how that works. Somebody's trying this recruiting technique, finding out how that works. We want them all in. I think ultimately what we want in Minnesota is this sort of a It's almost like a nuclear reactor full of people figuring out how to deliver these fantastic teachers to us, and we will work our way toward whatever that collection of institutions is that's going to deliver for us. And as long as we stay focused just on this one thing, guaranteeing effectiveness in our classrooms.
Well, and Madam Chair,
Representative Mariani.
And I'm encouraged by that. I think that's correctly right, that there should be. I think one of our failures over years here with charter schools, for instance, has not been the strong expectation, even though we stated it, that there ought to be some cross-sharing and learning going on. And now that is starting to happen, but it's 20 years down the road. Madam Chair, you asked a question which touches on a very specific question I have, and that has to do with, so who else is at the table informing and buying it and a whole bit. And the reason that I think that's an important question is because in order for us to move state statute, we're going to have some really strong buy-in from key stakeholders to change some current elements. And there's two that are interrelated. One is that currently right now in state statute under data privacy laws, we carve out a whole bunch of very important information that I think fits into your ability to push this agenda forward. That's all private. It's not public. And it seems to me that we're going to have to address that issue in order to sustain this kind of effort over the long term. So the two questions are, will this initiative and will the foundation and relate, will you be forwarding recommendations to us about specifically data privacy issues that we ought to be looking at and addressing? That's one. And two, will you also be forwarding to us a clear, strong set of parameters that defines what, in fact, an effective teacher is, as Minnesota state law ought to recognize it?
Mr. Hutchinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Marianne, we'll forward to you anything you ask us for. We will not forward to you anything unsolicited. We are a charitable research education organization. We don't lobby. We won't lobby. But we're happy to answer any question and share with you all the research that we've done. And we've done research on all of those topics. Because we know, at least for what we're trying to do, it's pretty important. But we think as a matter of policy, it's going to be important to sustaining this stuff in the long run.
Madam Chair, let's solicit that.
We ask you to provide that for us. Thank you very much. Representative Kath.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I want to say thank you so much for your presentation today. I think it's critical what you're doing in bringing about some teacher effectiveness and changing the way that we look at how we train those teachers before they enter our classroom. Specifically for me is the fact that a cap and gown does not dismiss a post-secondary institution from recognizing they still have a duty to those graduates as they enter into our schools. And the training that you're doing there and the mentorship is critical. But you spoke to something today that hit me like a ton of bricks, and it was that I got an email from one of these change makers in one of my small rural school districts. And I'm going to tell you that the idea of recruiting and marketing in a small rural school district is very different than a suburban or a metro school district where there are opportunities for these teachers that as they see changes in the districts and things like that, that they can seek alternatives. And you hit on something that I think we as a committee really have to talk about as policymakers, and that is it's not necessarily about what they're making in those first few years. It's about can I, once I'm tenured and I decide that this is my career path forever, because once you're a teacher, that's the end of the road. There's no room for advancement unless you go back to college. Once they make that decision, I had a teacher that just emailed me and he said, you know, I'm 2 years away from that 10-year mark, just got married, I had my first child, and now you legislators told me that you're going to put a 2-year pay freeze. I don't know if I can stay in this profession if that's the jeopardy that I face every time that there is a concern up at the state about my profession and where I'm going. And I think that's really critical for us in these rural districts when people are making a choice to move into that area. And they want to know that if they're going to stay there, are they going to be able to raise a family and be able to sustain that? The question I have for you, do you believe that policy like that will challenge you in your marketing or your recruitment of good teacher candidates, and how do we overcome that?
Mr. Hutchinson.
Madam Chair, Representative Cash, yes. We're going to try this spring to launch a statewide marketing campaign, and You know, it's like anything else in life. If you got the wind behind you, it's one thing. If you got the wind coming in your face, it's a whole other deal. And so I think it really does matter what other messages are being sent about teaching and about our expectations and our aspirations. I think it will all matter. Everything will matter, and it will matter differently in different places. I think your other point is very powerful. When we did the research, we looked a little bit at the difference between the challenges in rural versus suburban versus urban, and the same four variables are in play. They may be in play in slightly different combinations, but it's the same basic four variables. But different places are more attractive than others. And so we're going to need to be able to overcome some of that. And, you know, it's hard to know what the arc of the story is going to be this year, right? If you're at the beginning of the beginning, and we're going to live with whatever it is. But I can tell you that if the arc of the story is that it's all about money and not about teaching, that's not going to help us. If the arc of the story is it really is about teaching, and we have very high expectations and we have very high aspirations and we're willing to make policy changes to make that possible, that's a whole different situation. And that's why we're so happy to be here this morning, not because we know the answer, but I think we got a pretty good angle on the possibilities. And our only hope is that kind of question will be with you throughout. Because I remind you where we started. We are going to replace half of all the teachers. And we're going to make decisions that decide who those teachers are going to be. And some of those will be intentional and some will be unintentional. I just ask you to keep asking, what's the unintentional consequence of the stuff we're thinking about?
Representative Depke and members, we have to be out of here in a couple minutes, so let's make this really good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just loved your presentation. I loved your response to Representative Dabney's question, and it's certainly you have bipartisan support in this room, which is just great. I particularly am excited about your fourth tier, which is that cooperation between higher ed and K-12, and I have wondered for years why it has taken us so long to get to this point. And Dr. Hegard, one of the things that you said was that your higher ed institutions that you're partnering with, that you admire their courage for working with you on this partnership. I want to know why they have to have courage to do this. It, to me, it's common sense, and I just wanted to know why.
Ms. Hegard.
Madam Chair, Representative, first of all, thank you for the promotion. I have two doctors in my family, but I'm not one of them.
Sorry about that.
That's all right. All right. A lot of the work that we're doing at the Bush Foundation, we talk about courage. It's really hard to step out and be willing to do things differently. So whether you're talking about a teacher at a K-12, you know, at a school, or you're talking about a professor who's trying to lead this change effort for their institution, it takes a lot of courage to stand up to your peers who may not necessarily see things the way that you do. So whether it's a president or a provost or a dean or a faculty member, we're trying to make sure that they feel supported by us. We're poking them and prodding them, but we're also making sure that they understand that we're behind them. And it really does take courage because many, many of these institutions have done things the same way. Changes occurred around the edges for decades, and it's hard to step out and do things differently. But we have to.
Ms. Hegard, is either of you able to come back at another time? We have still so many questions, leave here because we have another committee coming in. Mr. Hutchinson, did you want to say one last thing?
This is a connection between this last question and Representative Dabney's question. Change is the hardest thing in the world for an institution to do. Because even though the leaders and everybody may want to change, the surrounding environment is used to the things the way they are. And maybe even subconsciously pushes back against the change.
And so for a president to say, I'm going to guarantee the effectiveness of the teachers that come out of this institution, they have to know that everybody thinks that's crazy. Everybody thinks it can't be done. Nobody believes it's possible. And one of our jobs, and again, I mean us all here, is to surround these courageous leaders with evidence that change is necessary, that change is possible, that it will be encouraged, will reinforce their courage, because they're getting all these signals every single day. You shouldn't do this. Don't go there. You step out on that limb, somebody's going to chop that off. You're not going to make it. You're going to fail. You're going to embarrass us. I mean, there's a trillion reasons not to do this, and frankly, not enough reasons to do it. I think part of your opportunity is to create an environment in which they get rewarded sort of spiritually, but maybe in a lot of other ways from a policy point of view for the tough work they're being asked to do.
Thank you again, Ms. Hegard and Mr. Hutchinson. This meeting is adjourned.